Let's call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Monday, March 1st, 2021. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to do business. Present today, Senator Gary Stevens, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, Chairman Brivac is on the teleconference line, and I'll be chairing today in his stead of Vice Chair Senator Machicki. Staffing the committee today is Committee Aide Betty Tangeman, LAO moderated Nate Williams, and we have Chris Stickrell online from Records. Everyone, please turn off your cell phone. Today's agenda consists of a presentation on the Endangered Species Act. We have Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang of the Department of Fish and Game here as our presenter. For those of you who don't know, Commissioner Vincent Lang has at least a 34-year history of service with the department prior to accepting his current position on January of 19. In addition to his experience in both fisheries and wildlife management, Doug has served as the Endangered Species Act coordinator for the state of Alaska. Very pleased to have him here in person today. As we move along through the presentations, I'll be checking for questions. If you don't get your question answered by the end of the meeting, please let Betty know, Ms. Tangeman here, and she can follow up. And Commissioner, welcome. Please place yourself on the record and proceed.
For the record, my name is Doug Vincent Lang. I'm the Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So Chairman Brivac asked me a while back while we were out visiting that about the Endangered Species Act, and he thought it'd be good to kind of give the committee here an opportunity to talk about the Endangered Species Act, a little bit about how it was created and some of the issues the state is having with its implementation in the state. And I thought that would be a good idea, so I offered to do it. So thank you for indulging me, and we'll get started here. So my outline is going to be to define the Endangered Species Act, talk a little bit about the state of Alaska's position with respect to that act, a little bit about the ESA process, and then give a couple of examples of how the ESA works in Alaska, then some issues with the current implementation of the act that we're experiencing in the state, a current status of ESA listings in our state, and then a little bit about the consultation process and some issues we're seeing with that in the state, then finally some legal considerations. So first off, the ESA was adopted by President Nixon in 1973. And the purpose was to protect critically imperiled species from extinction. The key word there was critically imperiled species and to prevent their extinction. And then the second purpose was to recover those species that were listed under the act to the point where legal protections were no longer needed. The net effect of the Endangered Species Act is to put species in the habitats that they occupy that the federal government alone determines to be critically imperiled under direct federal control and adopts a comprehensive federal regulatory oversight program on their species management and habitat management. So let me be absolutely clear about the state of Alaska's position. The state of Alaska supports the listing of species that are critically imperiled and at risk of extinction in the immediate future. We should do everything in our power to ensure that species under our watch don't go extinct. Our concerns instead revolve around the question of what constitutes critically imperiled and requires listing and how much federal oversight is really necessary to recover a species once it's listed. So let's take a look at where we have agreement. North Pacific right whales. State agrees that the listing of this species is in danger. There's about 30 individuals that are estimated to remain in the eastern stock, which occasionally occupies Alaskan waters. There's no question in the state of Alaska's mind that this species needs protection to prevent their extinction, and we should do everything in our power as a state to work with the federal government to make sure that this species doesn't go extinct and recovers to the point where protection is no longer needed. But let's look where we have disagreement. Ring seals. You know, we disagree with the listing of this species as threatened. This species currently numbers in the millions worldwide, yet the National Marine Fisheries Service determined that they are threatened with extinction in the foreseeable future. But by their own analysis, NOAA found that there will be no population impacts to this species in the next 50 years. However, this species was listed based solely on climatic modeling results that show something might happen in the next 100 years that warrants its listing today. As a result, this species is granted the same protections as the right whale that we just previously discussed, and NOAA recently proposed a designation of critical habitat for this species that is about the size of Texas off our coastline. Bottom line, we disagree with the listing of this species and are fighting in court to reverse it.
Commissioner, I want to welcome Senator Bishop to the resources meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being late. There's some other business.
So let's talk a little bit about the process of the ESA. It begins with either a public petition or an agency initiation of a species that people are concerned about its risk of extinction. And it starts out with what they consider, after they get that petition, 90-day finding. And the agency basically has 90 days to decide whether or not further analysis is necessary. 90-day findings can last 90 days, or in our experience, they can last a couple of years. So there's, but the fact is that it initiates whether or not there's enough of a threshold, kind of like a grand jury, as to whether or not to proceed to trial, in this case, a listing decision. That kicks off a 12-month status review, which is followed by a proposed decision. And then that goes up for public review, and then there's a final agency decision to either list or not list. After, if it's decided to list the species, that is followed by designation of critical habitat and establishment of a recovery team and development of a recovery objective. And then that process plays out as the species recovers or doesn't recover, and it can then go into uplisting, which means you can go from threatened to endangered, and go to downlisting, and go from endangered to threatened, or threatened to not being listed, or complete delisting of the species. So let's look at a couple examples across the state of Alaska. The Aleutian Canadian goose, stellar sea lions, polar bears, and beluga whales in Cook Inlet. So the Aleutian Canada goose. This species was listed as endangered in 1967. There was a recovery plan adopted in 1974, and the main threat was predation by introduced foxes. And immediately the recovery team got to work, removed the foxes, and the threat was removed, and the species began recovery. The services did not define critical habitat. That's an option the services have. They don't have to define critical habitat if habitat is not a limiting factor. In this case, predation was the limiting factor, not habitat, so they didn't list critical habitat. The species was reclassified to threatened in 1990 and then finally delisted in 2001 as recovered. Again, it was a very clean species. We knew exactly what the threat was. We went out and dealt with it, and boom, it got the species recovered. Stellar sea lions.
Second, Commissioner okay. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Who introduced the foxes?
I think they were just, I don't think we ever tracked back down to who they were, who introduced them. Probably came off a ship, I'm guessing. So let's look at stellar sea lions. They were listed as threatened in 1990. In this case, the NIMS decided to establish critical habitat in 1993 because they determined that prey-based fish were important prey base for stellar sea lions, so they wanted to protect the habitat of the prey base. The western stock was uplisted to endangered in 1997. There's two stocks in the stellar sea lion group in Alaska, the western stock and the eastern stock. The eastern stock is basically what occupies Prince William Sound down through southeast Alaska. The western stock kind of goes from Prince William Sound over to the Aleutians. A fishery biop was prepared as part of a consultation process, and fishing was restricted beginning in 1998. A recovery plan was adopted in 1992 and revised in 2008, and recovery objectives were established. The population had to grow at 3% per year for 30 years. Growth must be occurring throughout the range, and threats facing the stocks eliminated or monitored. And they estimated the total cost associated with research to get to that at $430 million over that 30-year period of time. So what's the current status? The eastern stock remains threatened, and the western stock remains endangered. So the state, this is an interesting case. So the state, rather than fight the listing and the establishment of critical habitat, what we did in this case is we used federal dollars matched with state GF dollars to actually collect information on the species, to collect fishery information and to collect diet information and population demographic information on stellar sea lions. When the federal biop came out that time and restricted fishing unnecessarily, We actually stepped in and sued the federal government on that buyout. We brought our state science into the process, and when we did that, we were able to demonstrate to the judge that the federal science was wrong. We overturned the buyout, forced them to rewrite a new one, which basically resulted in a lot less fishery restrictions to Alaskan fisheries. So you can, if you're persistent, use state science to fight these buyouts, but you have to have data to basically go against the federal data, because the federal data has deference in federal court.
Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, thank you. And it was sort of explained there at the end, using federal science dollars within the state. Is there more to it? I guess I'm seeing a couple pages ahead on page 18, 19, 20. Are there, how do you do that? So you say we disagree, and then challenge is, does it always have to go through Superior Court, or does it go through, is there a appeal process in place?
So, and I'll get to this a little bit later, but every step in that ESA process is litigatable, and that's part of the problem. It's litigatable by the state of Alaska, or it's litigatable by NGO communities that are out there watching the federal process. So we have two choices. We can either try to litigate a listing or the designation of critical habitat, or we can try to collect state science to try to battle the decisions that are made as a result of the listing or as a result of the designation of critical habitat. This is an example where we used state data that, unfortunately, we were able to collect with federal dollars to prove that the federal science was not the best available science to make those decisions, and we got a federal judge to agree with us.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just trying to work between the idea of the stellar sea lion and the ringed seals and the fact that these divided into an eastern stock and a western stock. So it appears to me like talking about ringed seals, there's lots of them around the world. How did this happen that we divided it into two stocks? If one stock was healthy, though they are not, but say it was fully recovered, would you still then close down the other stock? I mean, aren't we talking about the total number of stellar sea lion, not just the different regions? Any reflection on that?
So there's originally stellar sea lions were listed as an entire stock. And then basically through genetic information, we had an eastern stock and a western stock, and we had different recovery rates between those stocks. So the federal government realized that, and they basically treated them as two different stocks that allowed them to have different listing criteria for each species. So the eastern stock was meeting its recovery objectives, so they got downlisted, where the western stock wasn't meeting its recovery objectives, so it remained listed as endangered. And as a result of that, there's differential fishery restrictions in the western stock versus the eastern stock.
That is interesting, and it adds another complexity to it, because other creatures could be treated the same way, that right. Quite healthy in one area but endangered in another.
So with ring seals, there are no population demographic separations between ring seals. Now, there's a worldwide population that numbers in the millions. In Alaska, it's tens of thousands, but the U.S. Endangered Species Act, even though they've determined the entire worldwide population is at risk of is threatened with extinction in the foreseeable future, they can only apply the recovery planning and the critical habitat in U.S. waters, because they can't go outside U.S. waters.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner, I have a question from Senator Rivak as well. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Senator Rivek. I really appreciate you being here, Commissioner. I wish I could be there. Unfortunately, I had a close contact, and so I'm quarantining to make sure that I'm not putting anybody at risk. So that being said, I have a question since we're back on the ring seals. So you mentioned here that the NOAA analysis found that there will be no population impacts for the next 50 years. Folks have speculated to me that the reason the federal government might try and list something like this as endangered is to sort of skirt some of the promises that Alaska should have under ANILCA and other federal laws. Can you speak to that at all, or it might that be might that be a cause of this, or are they really endangered?
Well, I think the state of Alaska does not believe this species should be listed, ring seals. There's many of them. The in our eyes, 50 years is well beyond what is foreseeable. There might be impacts out 50 to 100 years, but you certainly don't put the same level of resources onto ring seals in terms of preventing their extinction as you do North Pacific right whales. And in essence, what you're doing by doing that, you're putting the same levels of protection on both those species. We should be protecting those species that are most at risk, in my eyes. And I think the net effect of the Endangered Species Act is it removes species that are listed, and state management of those species is removed. It's given to the federal government, and the habitats they occupy are now under a level of federal control. So I think there are some people that do believe that part of the underpinning of this is to put more species under state, under federal control, as well as their habitats.
Thank you. And just a quick follow-up, and I won't stop you. Maybe you get to this later on. But what does it mean if all these ring seals and their habitats were listed endangered? What does that mean for the areas in which these animals are found? I mean, what does that mean to the rest of Alaskans?
Well, I'll get to a little bit later, but I'll try to answer your question now, Mr. Chair. As soon as a species is listed, take is prohibited. Direct take is against the law, as well as incidental take, which is defined as any level of harassment, which is what we're seeing right now with polar bears. So if an activity is going to occur that's going to take a ring seal, either directly or indirectly, it now requires a federal permit. In addition, anything that potentially adversely modifies the habitat or jeopardizes that habitat will now be under a federal permit, especially if it occurs on federal land. So yeah, this, all of a sudden the area size of Texas is now subject to a jeopardy and adverse modification finding if it's in their habitat, and is requiring an incidental take permit to ensure that animals aren't harassed on the landscape. And that's not killing them, that's just, you know, modifying their behavior.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, just a clarifying question. You talked about the habitat just now, but earlier you also talked about management of the species itself. I mean, your examples here are three marine mammals and a migratory bird. They're not really subject to much state management, right?
That's correct. This has basically been in the marine mammal world up until now, but you'll start seeing that we're seeing increased number of non-marine mammals being, the same strategy being used in non-marine mammals.
I have two questions. One is, wasn't the polar bear determined to be ESA due to modeling as well, that there's not actually a quantity problem today, but they're worried about the future?
Yeah, I think we have polar bears next.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Environmental groups petition the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list polar bears as endangered due to climate change impacts. In May of 2008, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service listed polar bears as threatened based on the fact that climate change will result in a decline of sea ice habitats, and lost habitat will threaten currently healthy populations with extinction over the next 50 to 100 years. They didn't see that there was any risk to polar bears going extinct in the next 35 years, and then slowly over the next 50 to 100 years, they started predicting, because of sea ice habitat, you would lose polar bears completely. So the state of Alaska, I'll get to this in a second. The state of Alaska opposed that listing. We actually went to court on it. We felt that we had to draw a line in the sand as to what was foreseeable. And we clearly felt that modeling to predict a currently healthy species with extinction over the next 50 years was not foreseeable in our eyes and had too much doubt associated with it. We lost that case in court. The judge ruled that basically the service is free to define foreseeable future as far out as they want, and they have the discretion to determine whether or not that is statistically valid in their eyes. So as a result of that polar bear listing, now we have a Section 4D rule, which defines the scope of the Section 7 consultation process. We have critical habitat that was designated. Basically, any place a polar bear could roam or might roam in the future was designated. And we have a recovery plan that was created. And because polar bears are not only listed under the ESA, they are also covered under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The recovery objective became not what is necessary to prevent the extinction of the species. Rather, it was what was required to recover the species to their optimal sustained yield numbers, which is much higher than what is required to prevent their extinction. So they mixed the Marine Mammal Protection Act with the ESA and basically took the best of the worlds in their eyes and set those as recovery objectives. And in Alaska, they're like, for instance, the Chukchi population, which is currently healthy and robust, their OSY numbers are much higher than what's necessary to prevent extinction. So the current status in Alaska, there's two subpopulations, the Chukchi Sea population, which, again, we studied in the Soses Fish and Wildlife Service. That population is healthy and viable. And the southern Beaufort population, which has declined in numbers, but that decline has stabilized as a result of habitat changing. In short, in our eyes, there aren't any immediate risk of extinctions. The other thing that this, what happened with polar bears, is the service listed polar bears, the worldwide population of polar bears, at being at risk of extinction. They did not list the 19 different subpopulations of polar bears that were identified in the Marine Mammal Protection Act as either threatened or endangered. What they did is they then drilled down from the worldwide listing in terms of recovery objectives and used those 19 different subpopulations and set recovery objectives for each one of those subpopulations, which has a real tremendous impact on the amount of incidental takes you see on the North Slope. So for instance, if you're calculating the amount of incidental takes that are allowed on a worldwide population, that would be a much higher number. If you're just defining it based on the southern Beaufort population, which is now about 900 bears, versus the OSY number, which is 1,600 bears, you don't have many incidental takes that you could have. But yet we know on the North Slope polar bears in the Chukchi, polar bears in the southern Beaufort population, and polar bears in the northern Beaufort population, which occupies habitat, are genetically identical, and they basically intermix at any single time. So there's a lot of messes in as a result of how you listed a species worldwide versus how you're managing the recovery at a subpopulation level.
Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, is U.S. Fish and Wildlife still collaring these bears, still tracking them, still monitoring them?
They are worried about the population level impact that research is having. So my understanding is they backed away from collaring, and they now are trying non-handling methods to estimate population to try to not result in a harassment of the bears, which. Which is interesting because when you look at other populations of listed species in the lower 48, for instance, California condors, every single one of those animals that were released into the wild were monitored. They were not only collared, but they were captured annually to test lead levels. So at some point in time, you can't just list them and walk away from them for fear of studying them. In our eyes, you have to study them.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The issue of climate change, now that's something we have no control over. We may have some control over fishing, for example, and maybe stellar sea lion, but with climate change, I mean, are we going to be put in a position where there's, maybe take polar bear, as they have to move north, that we see, like pollock we see is moving north, and king crabs seem to be moving north. If we find that climate change forces the polar bear to move north, are we still going to have to protect the polar bear in the south? I guess I don't know if polar bear is the right example of that, but climate change being out of our control, how can we be required to maintain a species if climate change causes it to move to a different area?
Well, that was one of the most interesting things on the listing of the polar bear. The Fish and Wildlife Service in their listing documents said that there is little that they can do with respect to climate change. So they decided, even though the climate change was identified as a primary threat, that they couldn't address it through the Endangered Species Act, so they would manage the rest of the threats that were out there, which they had considered to be inconsequential at the time of listing. So now you see with the listing impacts is that, you know, this has significantly impacted seismic work on, in Anwar or on the North Slope. Even though at that time of listing, oil and gas operations weren't considered to be a cause of the probability of extinction, climate change was. It's now having an impact through incidental take regulations on what can happen in Anwar or what can happen on the North Slope in oil and gas. It's also impacting traditional uses of bears by our native people. So native people still harvest bears, but what we're seeing is the population declines in some of these subpopulations that the amount of bears that can be taken by native Alaskans for traditional customary purposes is going down. And then bottom line, it's starting to impact the interest in Alaska as a place to do business because you just don't know whether or not you're going to be able to have an oil well that you've bid on through the leasing process and then put money into research in that by doing seismic that you'll be able to operate it. And I think we're seeing that increasingly, especially in NPRA as we move forward with people challenging the decision to permit those by the federal government.
Senator Kawasaki and then Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Commissioner. So under the State's Endangered Species Act, it was actually written in 1971, just 2 years before the federal ESA. It says for determining under 162190, determining endangered species goes through the species. In making the determination, Commissioner Fish and Game shall consider destruction and drastic modification or severe curtailment of its habitat. That's what is now known as climate change, I guess. Two, its overutilization for commercial or sporting purposes. I don't know if that's the case. The effect of its disease or predation. I don't know that that's the case. And other natural or man-made factors affecting its continued existence. So when you make the determination under 162190, are you using those four? Are you using those four as opposed to what U.S. Fish and Wildlife has done?
Yeah, so we interesting enough, we don't have the word foreseeable in our definition anywhere in our state statute. So we actually consider that. And we looked at polar bears because we have an obligation to look at them under the state statute, and we could not come to the conclusion that polar bears were at risk of extinction in the foreseeable future. Now, that's not to say that there's a possibility that extinction might occur sometime in the next 100 years. We certainly don't think we need to put the resources on that, for instance, as we would with a species like the North Pacific right whale, which is immediately facing risk.
So follow up. I guess I'm a little bit concerned with hearing that it may not be extinct. You're talking about within the state of Alaska, but not internationally then. Right. Is that what you're referring to?
Right.
It's just a concern that, you know, I want to make sure that polar bears, Alaskan polar bears are here.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably a different species than a lot of other polar bears across the globe. And I know there's some pros and cons to doing both, but hopefully we could do both.
Yeah.
Have a healthy population, you know, have continued drilling. Senator Stevens is right. We're not going to get away from the climate changing. There's some things we can do, some things we have beyond our control. But I like to hear that, you know, someday our kids will be playing with polar bears. You know, maybe they've migrated a little bit closer to Fairbanks to enjoy the weather, but and food. But I don't know if I like to hear that we may in fact see them extinct in Alaska.
Well, through the chair, so I think in the case of polar bears, I think the state of Alaska agrees with you. I think we should be doing everything we can to ensure monitoring that population to ensure it doesn't become extinct. But do we throw the entire weight of a federal and state regulatory, you know, process to ensure that when even under their own estimates, the risk of extinction was hovering in the 1 to 2 or 3% range? I think we have much bigger things that we can worry about. Now, that said, I agree with you. I think we should be closely monitoring that species over the next 20 or 30 years and make sure that species isn't going extinct. What's happening with polar bears worldwide is, you know, the first population that really should have gone extinct if sea ice was gone was some of the population in Hudson Bay. They have no spring sea ice left. Those populations decreased and recalibrated at a lower number, but now have stabilized at those lower numbers. which I suspect we're going to see in the northern Bulford. And I'm not sure that northern, southern Bulford population bears simply died jumping into the ocean. They probably moved over to the Chukchi, and they probably moved over to the northern Bulford. But because we don't have a northern Bulford population estimate but once every 10 years because it's up to Canada, you know, we'll know in the next couple of years when they conduct an estimate whether that population is growing.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, do you know how long the polar bear has been on the planet?
I should know that, but it's been years since.
Is it about 10,000 years?
Something like that, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I had a question as we were working through this earlier, but I don't know where the right place to ask. But on migratory birds, what if the Arctic tern became endangered and they started working through the process as to whether or not it was going to be listed, and we found that the impacts are on the southern end and not in Alaska? How would something like that be handled? It's a little bit similar to the ring seal thing, but not exactly. How would that, would even though the U.S. can't list something as being endangered in South America, how would it be handled here in Alaska?
So they would probably look at it in a worldwide population and decide whether it was threatened or endangered. If they determined it was threatened or endangered, they then look at what habitat that's occupied by. So if the U.S. becomes a part of the habitat that's occupied migrationally, they would probably designate those migrational routes as critical habitat. They would identify it as a threatened or listed species in Alaska, and they would identify the critical habitat that's used for migration as necessary for prevent the extinction of that species.
So just to follow up on that, so if you found that the South American habitat had been decimated because of something they'd been doing, and we knew that the habitat here was secure, you would still potentially be under the risk, even though you have no control of what happens moving forward, you could possibly suffer the same consequences.
And that's exactly the case we have potentially facing us with yellow-billed loons. The primary threat with yellow-billed loons is in the lower, is in the South China Sea, where they're living. Alaska habitats is largely secure, but they come up here to nest and fledge, and so we would probably end up with having yellow-billed loon habitat in Alaska listed as necessary as protection, even though that's not the limiting factor.
Senator Bishop?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I had a follow-up on the polar bear. Commissioner, do you have any documented cases of interbreeding between polar bears and grizzly bears in the interior?
It occurs, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So let's look briefly at beluga whales in Cook Inlet. So beluga whales were over-harvested in the early to mid-1990s. In 1998, largely as a result of that over-harvest, National Marine Fisheries Service initiated a status review to list beluga whales in Cook Inlet as endangered. That meant that this species is going to be is at the imminent risk of extinction. In 2000, National Marine Fisheries determined that the whales are not endangered of extinction. Wait, I'm sorry. In 1998, they listed it. In 2000, they initiated a status review. In 2000, they determined that they were not at danger of extinction and chose not to list them under ESA. Instead, they listed them as depleted under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. They revisited that decision in 2008, where the population was about the same number as what it was in 2000, and they again, at that point in time, listed them as endangered, given that the population was not increasing as fast as expected after harvest was regulated, and the population had a greater than 1% chance of going extinct in the next 100 years. This is when the first time that we actually saw the 1% measure come into place. So National Marine Fisheries Service determined that beluga whales, if the threshold, anything greater than 1%, required them to list it as endangered. That's a pretty low threshold. So based on that, they established critical habitat in Cook Inlet. A recovery plan has been developed that sets the recovery goals to optimal sustained yield numbers. Now, There was a Sioux Hydro study way back when that determined that the population of beluga whales in Cook Inlet was about 1,700. They developed new methodology, and the current population hovers somewhere around 400 to 500. And it's been steady over that time. But the recovery objective, again, isn't necessary to prevent the risk of extinction, which is probably a population of about 500 whales. It is to grow the population back under MMPA to a number that's based on a percentage of its optimal numbers, which they determine is 1,700. So you have to grow this population back to 1,500 whales before it's no longer listed under the Endangered Species Act. So now we are seeing a whole wide variety of lawsuits that are impacting oil and gas operations as a result of this listing. And the state is actively engaged as an intervener in those cases. And National Marine Fisheries Service has just begun stating its intent to examine fishery impacts on these whales with an eye towards restricting fisheries because they feel that prey is affecting the recovery of the species.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just MMPA, Marine Mammal Protection Act, is that correct?
Yes.
Senator Bishop?
Yeah, I just got to make a comment. Is there any possibility that maybe some of these oil and gas companies could raise these belugas in captivity and release them into Cook Inlet to help alleviate some of this problem? And the reason I say that is if you could give me just a second of literary license here.
Absolutely, Senator.
So this is a headline I pulled off the national news 2 days ago. Energy company to breed endangered California condors to replace birds killed by turbine blades, wind turbines. So a green energy company is working with a California environmentalist, the National Fish and Wildlife Service, to grow the condors that you spoke of earlier in captivity because they know that they're going to they haven't killed a bird yet, but they know the bird strikes are inevitable, and they're working together, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the environmentalist, and the energy company, raising birds in captivity to, you know, because we're trying to get to this goal of green energy. So I'm going, okay, well, if we're allowing this here in California to happen with an endangered species, you know, I'm going, maybe this is a new paradigm that we could do in Alaska.
So beluga whales is an interesting thing because they're genetically one population across the state of Alaska. But what you have now is populations that used to, like Bristol Bay and Cook Inlet, that used to intermix through Shelikof Straits. But about 25 years ago, the Marine Mammal Protection Act came in place, and it started regulating the harvest of marine mammals. Well, one of those marine mammals is orcas. And now orcas are, I don't know if many of you are out in Shelikof Straits. I know you get out there. There's a lot of orcas now running around Shelikof Straits. And they like to eat one thing, belugas. So I think what's really happened in Cook Inlet to a large extent is we now have killer whales that are increased in numbers that are segregating that population, that not allowing immigration from other sources into Cook Inlet. Mm. And in addition, you're basically forcing them into a very narrow habitat range that's in the northern part of the inlet, where in the past they used to occupy almost the entirety of the inlet. And we somewhat know that because, again, we did not challenge this listing in court. We decided to collect science, so we put a bunch of sonny buoys out in Cook Inlet, the middle part and the lower part, and we didn't hear belugas in the middle part of the inlet and the lower part down by Catchmack Bay, but one thing we did pick up a lot of was killer whale sounds. So the other thing was that NIMS decided to look at beluga whales in Cook Inlet, but there was a pod of whales that occupied the Akatat area, which was numbered in the 12 to 13. That was geographically isolated too. They chose not to look at that group of whales. So it's just interesting how they chose to look at one population but not another population. And in essence, you know, you probably have a population that's in a smaller habitat because of killer whales that probably will never be able to grow up to 1,500 whales, which is the OSY number, because the habitat's been constrained, unless you're willing to do something about killer whales.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, I'd had a question on you talked about the recovery numbers and what's an appropriate level of recovery number. And I guess what you're describing as the federal goals actually sort of seem to match with the state goals in the Alaska Endangered Species Act, right? The goal is supposed to be not just conserve and protect, but restore and propagate. So how do you interpret the Alaska instruction in statute to be different than what the feds are doing with ESA?
So I don't think you need to grow the population back to a historic level under the state one. I think you need to get it to a point where you're ensuring that that species doesn't go extinct. So what is a genetically, what's the right genetic number of whales in Cook Inlet? You know, by genetic information, you need a population of about 500 to ensure that you have good diversity in the population. So to me, I'd probably be happy with 400 to 500 whales in Cook Inlet. I don't think we need to grow that population back up to 1,500 whales to require the same level of protection as you do one that's sitting down at 300. So I think it's in my mind, it becomes a question of where are you going to put your resources? And to me, those are the ones that are most critically at risk of extinction in my eyes, the immediate future, rather than what you could potentially foresee as a future. And I fundamentally have issues with the fact that I would throw those resources at a species that had a 1% chance of extinction over the next 100 years. That threshold is way too low, and I ask people, you can list that species. What species is not potentially listable using those kinds of thresholds?
I can think of several, but we'll go back.
Yeah, there are a lot of species that you could potentially start listing with that level of, including things like sockeye salmon because of ocean acidification. So if the threshold is 1% over 100 years. Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Stevens.
Well, I'm not sure, after thinking about this, I'm not sure I really have a good question, but I think it's fascinating to hear about the Chertoff Strait issue where the beluga whales from Cook Inlet and Bristol Bay no longer can get together because of the issue of the killer whale. So I know in some areas you do control species. I don't know anything about wolves, but we don't have any on Kodiak, but I know that sometimes for maybe caribou or you want to control the population of wolves. Can you control the population of killer whales? Is that even a possibility?
Not under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, but there is one.
Even if they doubled or tripled in that?
Yeah. So there is one instance where one listed species, that the federal government allowed one listed species population to be managed to protect another one. That's in the Columbia River. They had a population of stellar sea lions that was eating a population of endangered salmon and steelhead trout, and they basically made a determination that they could lethally take some of those stellar sea lions to ensure that the more at-risk species was. Which, again, as you list more species at this 1% threshold level, you end up with these conflicting species goals where you have – there's a case in Hawaii where – I think I was talking to the Hawaii director about a year ago. They have about a 4-square-mile area that has 27 listed species on it, and it all is designated as critical habitat. And I said, well, how do you manage that? And he goes, we manage it based on the species most at risk at that current time, which varies between years. So the critical habitat factors that you need for species A is completely different than what you need for species B. And he says, it's just a mess. So the more species you list, the more difficult it becomes to balance that ecosystem.
Right.
Yeah. Commissioner Senator Machicki here. Is there a point where the extreme management options take place? Is there a threshold under ESA? We talked about the California condor, and you talked about the Columbia River stellar sea lions. Is there a threshold that allows that level of control for the predatory species?
I think probably not. It's discretionary within the federal agencies, so there's no specific standard that's required.
Okay. So if the problem is the people in the archipelago of Kodiak, you couldn't actually work it from that angle, is that correct?
Yeah.
I'll let you continue. You don't need to answer that.
So just briefly, let's take a look
I'd
at
like
a couple.
I'd like to hear an answer to that.
So let's take a brief look at it, the issues that the state of Alaska sees with the implementation of the ESA. So the first question we have is, what is appropriate when modeling populations being considered for listing? So how far in the future can you reasonably predict population trends? You know, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, 300 years. Again, with belugas, it was 1% at 100 years. And what is a reasonable level of extinction risk? 1%, 10%, 20%, 25% over that period of time? And I guess we're increasingly concerned that the levels of risk extinction in the foreseeable future is way too conservative for our point of view. We wouldn't list those species at 1% over 100 years under the state law. We would probably look at something more immediate. Is it facing extinction in the next 10 to 20 years? And is the extinction rate at someplace higher than 1%? Is it, you know, a 10 or 20% chance of extinction?
Commissioner, I have a question. This is Senator Maticki again. What did the Endangered Species Act not include a threshold for? I mean, is it arbitrary at this point, or what was the threshold defined in the act?
It is discretionary to the federal agency to define what they can foresee into the future and what level of risk that they want to accept.
Interesting.
So for climate-related listings, I guess, you know, we're asking, is it possible to save all species in their historic ranges when the ecosystems are changing due to climate change? Mm-hmm. Assuming climate is changing ecosystems, how should critical habitat be established and defined? How would recovery objectives be written, especially for species that are currently at healthy levels but are projected to decline? Could you ever recover a species that's occupying a very small habitat that has climate impacts to the point that you can recover them when the habitat underneath them is disappearing, not because of anything that they're being overhunted for that you can manage? Should a species be listed even if the cause cannot be reasonably addressed by the ESA? And again, what could not be listed, you know, using a 1% chance over 100 years of due to climate change? You know, what potentially is not listable? For recovery objectives, are recovery objectives set too high? Can threats ever be completely removed? Can population targets be reached and sustained? And MMPA and ESA have different criteria for delisting. Should ESA recovery standards be the same as those for delisting under the Marine Mammal Protection Act? We don't believe so. We believe that a species could be delisted under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, I mean under ESA, because the threat of extinction has been removed, but managed under the MMPA to get it back up to OSY numbers. For critical habitat, what is truly critical? Do you need an area the size of Texas for ring seals? Are excessive designations really necessary? And what is considered de minimis impact? One of the things we argued with the designation of 200,000 square miles of critical habitat for polar bears was that this opened up the entirety of that range to adverse modification findings by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And they assured us that, nope, Doug, don't worry about it, because any small impact in this vast amount would be considered de minimis. Well, that's not what we're seeing on the landscape. We're seeing very de minimis things that affect less than 0.1% of habitat being considered to be an adverse modification that's resulting in the lack of a permit being given out. So this is a map of currently or proposed critical habitat off our coastlines. You can see pretty much after the ring seal and the humpback whales are designated that almost the entirety of our coastline is now designated as critical habitat for one species or another. And what's interesting when you look at this map is the, you know, we initially had very small designations of critical habitat, but now we're seeing, you know, basically any place these species occupy. And this map differs considerably from the map for whales off the east coast of the United States, where there's important shipping and other considerations. The east coast of the United States, they have whale habitat, and they've rather than designating the entire coastline of the East Coast as critical habitat for whales, they've designated very discrete areas that were important for feeding or very discrete areas that were important for certain migration. It was not the entirety of the range. So Alaska is being singled out for a differential application of critical habitat than we're seeing in the lower 48. And the same thing's true off the west coast with many of these whale species. And then finally, it's a lot easier to list than delist a species. About 2,000 plants and animals are currently listed as threatened or endangered under the ESA. An additional 300 species are being considered for listing. And to delist, the agency must determine that a species must no longer be in danger of becoming extinct and the threats it's facing have been eliminated and are monitored. So all the threats that they consider important must have been eliminated and a plan in place to ensure that they are monitored before the species can be delisted. Since inception, only 46 species that have been listed have been delisted, of which only 20 have been recovered, less than 1%.
Commissioner, Senator Michicki here. On how does MMPA and ESA work out when it collides with the no diminishment under ANILCA?
I think the federal government argues that the Endangered Species Act and Marine Mammal Protection Act supersede ANILCA. And I think they get through that through the Commerce Clause.
Yes. I'm sorry. Senator Rivek?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you mentioned earlier, this is all fascinating stuff. You mentioned earlier that litigation is sort of the avenue by which to challenge some of these listings, and even looking at this map is sort of shocking to me to see our entire coastline designated as critical habitat for one species or another, as opposed to other places in the lower 48. My question is, are we prepared to is your department prepared to have that conversation with the federal government? What do we need in order to do better research on our end, or is there something? Could you speak to some of that?
Yeah, certainly, through the chair. So we are trying to develop a record as part of our comment on the ring seal critical habitat and the humpback whale critical habitat, that what is truly necessary to protect this critical habitat? Is it the entirety of the range, or is it some smaller portion that truly is affecting that species recovery on the landscape? And we're asking the hard question: if all habitat is critical and you're throwing the resources at all habitat, are you truly throwing the resources at the most critically important habitat? And I guess I would argue that you really want to throw your resources at the most critical habitat and not worry about doing an adverse modification finding, for instance, on polar bears based on the fact that they might occupy Norton Sound. So we're trying to get to the bottom of what truly is critical and trying to get smaller listings rather than expansive listings, because I think the ESA was pretty clear that it did not see establishment of occupied range as critical habitat, rather some subportion of that occupied range that was truly critical to the species recovery is being identified. And we're trying that administratively now, and if we're unsuccessful, I think we may end up in court over that case.
So, Commissioner, to touch on that in my previous question, if we haven't challenged our rights under ANILCA, have we not created a precedent? Some of these critical habitat areas have been there for years now, and I wonder why states that don't have an agreement such as ANILCA have fared so much better. You talked about, primary shipping lanes and things like that, but the reason for ANILCA was for us to have some control over our own development, and it looks like even though we think we have the protection of ANILCA, we have less standing than some of those other states. How do you put those two together, and should we not be litigating on previous critical habitat listings?
Yeah, I think we are poised to have that discussion with ringed seals and humpback whales. So we chose not to challenge the polar bear ESA critical habitat designation, but we didn't feel we had the record there. But in this case, I think we're building the administrative record that will allow us to point out how, first off, we're being treated differently than other states, and truly that you don't, that the ESA did not envision designation of occupied as critical.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Rivek.
Yes, thank you. Commissioner, is it right we do not currently have a division for specifically focused on marine mammals in fish and game? And if we don't, would it be beneficial, or what are your thoughts on more research related to marine mammals in Alaska?
So we don't have a division, but we have a section in the Wildlife Conservation Division that deals with marine mammals. And I think most of you know that in the governor's proposed budget, there's a $4 million capital budget that's looking to use $3 million worth of federal receipt authority and $1 million of general fund to match that, to basically start collecting science on marine mammals, hopefully a lot of it on polar bears, to start pointing out and collecting information to better inform the decisions the service has. Because I think we've learned one thing: if you have the science behind you, you can challenge in federal court some of those decisions. And without sound science, it's all discretionary by the federal agencies.
Senator Rivek, are you fine with that?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think with such a, it seems like such an aggressive push by our federal partners, I just think it might be critical for the state of Alaska to be on top of the science, however that looks. And I appreciate, again, the information. I look forward to for future conversations on the issue, Commissioner.
So I don't know how much more time you have here, but I can quickly go through just just the current listings. And
another question. We've got some time. Okay. Thank you, Senator Rivek. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. I just want to comment and dovetail on Senator Rivek. You know, you and I have had this discussion before along his question, and I don't know what the right number is for employees in there, but, you know, we're spending who knows how much it's costing us as a state to defend ourselves, and we're going into court with both hands tied behind our back when we're relying on U.S. Fish and Wildlife data. I've always been a proponent of standing up a division that's adequately funded to make our case, to make our arguments in a federal court of law. And so I'll just leave it at that.
So maybe I can touch on that real quickly. So we did not challenge the ring seal decision, as I said earlier. We instead spent 5 years, largely through federal grants that are matched with general fund that we had left over in the capital budget, to collect science on ring seals. And we collected information on their demographics. We collected information on their health and their body condition, a whole wide variety of things. Over 5 years, we didn't see a single impact to ring seals. So rather than challenge that listing, we actually submitted a delisting petition for ring seals. The federal government recently denied our delisting petition. And they basically argued that despite the current health of the population over the last 5 years, and there was no negative impact over that 5-year period of time, they decided to keep their listing intact because, again, there is a 1% probability in the next 100 years that species could be seeing impacts. So we may end up in court on that one. That we tried a different approach to try to collect science to inform those decisions, and we may be more successful in this one. But again, that's based on state science that we're collecting on ring seals.
Commissioner, in the Washington case of predator control, that program that they executed on the Stellar Sea Lion, was it state or federal science that was utilized to make that decision?
There's so much science going on down there. It's, I think it was a combination of both.
Could you get us an answer?
I'm
curious. You don't need to answer right now, but I am curious if there was a partnership where they obviously reached some sort of agreement. So when we talk about the beluga whale predatory action from orcas, it'd be interesting to see at what point, if they remain that serious as continuing to list the beluga whale in Cook Inlet, if there are options, if the science could help us in a place. And I'm just using it as an example, but I'm curious if that ended up being a state partnership, which would support standing up a department for that purpose. Yeah. Okay.
So let's look at the current listing, status listing of species in the state of Alaska. So these are listed species: endangered, short-tailed albatross, Eskimo curlew, which has been presumed extinct, that was listed before the state of Alaska became a state. Lucian's shield fern, stellar sea lions, western stock, bowhead whales, fin whales, Cook Inlet beluga whales, humpback whales, and a whole wide range of other rare species, the North Pacific right whale, which I discussed earlier, the blue whale, sei whale, humpback sperm whale, and leatherback sea turtles. We have a range of threatened species, which include the spectacled eider, Steller's eider, polar bears, northern sea otter, southwest Alaska DPS, stellar sea lions, eastern population, the green loggerhead and olive ridley sea turtles, wood bison, less the experimental non-essential population that we have, and Mexican and western stock DPS of humpback whales. Let's talk a little bit about the wood bison. So it's an interesting case. Wood bison were largely gone from Alaska during probably as a result of climatic changes 10,000 years ago. So we wanted to reintroduce wood bison in the landscape. But because, again, the Fish and Wildlife Service looked at wood bison in the entirety of their worldwide range, they determined that wood bison, because they were threatened with extinction in Canada, were now threatened with extinction in the United States, even though there were no wood bison in the United States. So we, before we could reintroduce wood bison in the United States without fear of them immediately becoming listed as an endangered species, we had to go through this complex process of designating them as a non-essential population that is experimental. And although they're listed in Alaska, our populations with that designation allow, basically prevented critical habitat from being designated when we put them on the landscape, and allowed the state of Alaska, since there were experimental animals on the landscape and non-essential to the worldwide population, for us to manage, harvest, and take. So we could actually remove an animal if it ended up on a airstrip, for instance, in western Alaska, without fear of violating the Endangered Species Act. So although the Endangered Species Act generally has some very restrictive modes, there are some avenues, especially when you're trying to move species around due to climate-related impacts, that allows you to do that through these designations.
Can I just ask a brief question?
Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
What's the status of the herd now? And this just was about a decade ago we were discussing this. And
yeah, so we put them on the landscape, and the first year they did okay, then we had a big winter event, and of course, you know, they're used to reproducing on the flats out there at the down at Portage down there, which doesn't have nearly the deep snow that Noko has. So we lost a few animals, but that population's slowly growing. They're becoming accustomed to now calving in the wild, and predators haven't figured out how to eat them yet, which is good. So I suspect in the next 10 or 15 years, we'll have a population that's going to provide a harvestable surplus. We're actually talking about working with the Alaska Native Corporations to look at other land use areas that we could put bison on to increase the herd size.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I look forward to not drawing a tag for those either. so I guess a question about these under consideration, and I think you've got others, or, you know, the threatened and under consideration. seems to me that somewhere between the amazing Karnak says maybe they'll go extinct, mm-hmm. and oh my God, we're 10 years out, is the appropriate time to respond.
Right.
Can you talk, as we get into these that are under consideration or that are threatened, can you talk about what the department is engaging in to help these species recover, help these species not decline any further? I mean, what's our prevention activity?
Okay. So let's take a look at Alexander Archipelago Wolves. That's one that's currently under consideration. So we are actively monitoring that population. We got concerned about the level of harvest the last 2 years on that population. So now we're going to the Board of Game and we're going to actually ask for a ceiling requirement within 7 days of an animal being taken so we can control harvest. I'm not nearly as concerned about wolf population as I am something like a whale population where you had one calf every maybe 5 or 6 years being produced. Wolves, we know that we can take a population down relatively low when that population responds pretty quickly to in numbers and in growing. So in Alexander Archipelago Wolves, I'm convinced that we have the right management approach in place. I think we let the harvest get out of hand for a year, but now we've learned from that. We're going to put harvest, more timely harvest reporting in place so we can shut the seasons down. And we're watching the population in terms of how it interacts with our management regime. So I guess we do not believe Alexander Archipelago Wolves are at risk of extinction in the next 10 to 20 years. But that said, we're doing our part to make sure that we're not over-harvesting those animals, which is probably the largest threat to those animals.
Senator? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, if as we discuss these, we could talk about those. Yeah. Obviously, they vary, right? Some right. of them are species we harvest, and some we don't. But they're still all contemplated under the Alaska Endangered Species
right.
Act.
Yeah. So let's look at Pacific walrus again. We don't believe, and the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't list Pacific walrus at the time, but they're currently under consideration again because of potential lawsuits that they're facing. That. We are, in the meantime, collecting information through our marine mammal program on population demographics and reproductive success and looking at the numbers and finding out whether there's behavioral changes as a result of sea ice. As long as we continue to get those federal grants, we'll be closely monitoring that population. And again, that population is showing signs of stress that within the next 20 years, we feel those are going to go extinct. We'll probably work with the federal government to list that species. But we're not going to give that species the same level of protection or support that species given the same level of protection as something like the North Pacific right whale, which is really facing a high chance of extinction. Kitsilis murrelets is a small seabird. Again, the risk of extinction is not very high over the next 100 years for that species. We've been working very closely in collecting information through state grants, through our state wildlife grant programs to assess the populations of that, to look at the genetic variation across the state of Alaska. And I think our science, again, probably influenced Fish and Wildlife Service to not immediately list that species and to closely monitor it over the next several years. And I know with Kitsilis murrelets, through this Exxon Valdez oil spill, we just gave almost $250,000 to study that species. Get more information to inform that decision.
Commissioner, just warning you, we have 20 minutes okay. left if you want to get through the.
Okay.
I'll try to keep our members' questions for the end and then we can see what time we have left.
Lynn Canal herring, that's something we are studying. You know, we're out actively looking at it. We don't think that you know, herring kind of move around on the landscape quite a bit. I think that was a listing that was proposed by a proponent that was really against a mine that was occurring near Lynn Canal versus. Really concerned about the Lynn Canal herring stock going extinct. But, you know, again, we're studying that and we're looking at it very closely. And then one surprise us just recently is bumblebees, you know. And we don't know much about bumblebees, but we are going to start looking at bumblebees to try to get an assessment of just how many bumblebees might be in Alaska. And I can tell you, I have no idea how to estimate bumblebee populations in the state of Alaska. So I think we just need to figure out where they are in our landscapes. And then there's a whole bunch of migratory species outside Alaska that currently affect Alaska. Southern resident killer whales, like in Puget Sound. we are taking significant impacts to our fisheries to feed killer whales in Puget Sound. And I just don't believe that the harvest of 100 to 200 king salmon in southeast Alaska is affecting the reproductive success of killer whales in Puget Sound as much as things in Puget Sound are affecting them. For instance, water quality, the number of chemicals in the water in Puget Sound, the transportation in and out of Puget Sound, the water quality in Puget Sound. So, you know, there, even though a species is not listed, doesn't occupy Alaskan waters, it can be listed someplace else and it can have a tremendous impact in how we're managing our fisheries. And that's the case with Mexican humpback whales. You know, they feed occasionally in Alaskan waters, but they really, the reproductive impacts of that whale is probably more being affected by what's happening off the Mexican coastline than the Alaskan coastline. So we could end up with having cruise ship restrictions that force cruise ships to only operate during certain hours of the day if Alaskan waters are designated as critical habitat. Snake River Falls Chinook salmon is another example. We're having significant impacts to southeast Alaska treaty fisheries as a result of the number of fall Chinook salmon we take. And again, these numbers not in the thousands of fish we're harvesting, but we're harvesting, you know, in the tens and 20s and 100, maybe potentially those small numbers of fish. So what happens after listing? So this is what I was getting at. There's a couple sections of the Endangered Species Act that come into play. One is Section 9, which prohibits the take of a listed species. Under Section 3, take includes harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture, or collect, or attempt to engage in any such contact. So it doesn't, take is not defined as killing an animal. It's defined as any one of these kinds of activities that could potentially affect that animal's behavior. And oftentimes, because you don't know whether it affects it, it's often modeled. So let's take a look real quick at polar bear ITRs, we incidental take regulations. We know in the past that the approach the service had with incidental take regulations was we kind of monitored the polar bear population. We saw polar bears affected by or documented the cases where they were, how they got affected by different oil and gas operations. They've now decided that documented cases are no longer verifiable, so they're now using modeled results. So they now say that if you're flying a survey in an area, that if you're low level, that could potentially affect a bear that's denning under the ice. So they now say that every FLIR survey potentially has like a 5% chance of resulting in a take. Well, if that was the case, we would have potentially seen, I would guess, a lot of dead carcasses of bears on the landscape as the snow melted. We're not seeing that. So we're worried increasingly about the new methodology that's being used to estimate take as modeled of what might happen versus what's actually happening on the landscape. Section 7 is another. This is anything that has a federal nexus or a federal permit that's required. And it requires a biological assessment of things that might affect the critical habitat, as well as a jeopardy and adverse modification finding. And then for projects that have incidental take but no federal nexus, that's on state land, for instance, you can either do a habitat conservation plan to minimize or mitigate the impact of incidental take, or get a variance through creation of a habitat conservation plan. So in Alaska, this is the range of the listed or candidate species. And with Stuckley's butterflies now, Stuckley's bumblebees, you basically have the entire interior of Alaska now potentially as listed as within the range of a listed species in Alaska. So, and then the consultation process issues. So as more species are listed, it's more likely that minimization and mitigation efforts will conflict. What do you protect on the landscape? Do you try to conserve humpback whales, or do you try to conserve killer whales? You know, and they become conflicting. Recovery objectives will conflict, critical habitat needs will conflict, and climate impacts will be considered. So lastly, I'd like to talk a little bit about all agency decisions, as I said earlier, are subject to citizen litigation. from listing decisions to critical habitat designations to jeopardy and adverse modification findings. So we're subject now to litigation from any third-party source in how they're doing it, and that is definitely affecting federal decisions on how they're issuing permits out. They are very at risk due to NGO litigation. And this has a real potential to slow resource development projects and place decisions in the hands of judges, which I'd rather have decisions regarding recovery in the hands of biologists. So in summary, listing decisions will affect resource development in our state. Stellar sea lion mitigation measures and polar bear ITRs are two clear examples. Listing decisions and implementation should be based on reasonable conclusions. In our opinion, they should have reasonable time frames for population projections, reasonable levels of extinction risk, reasonable recovery objectives and goals, and reasonable establishment of critical habitat. So what's our current state strategy? We're going to challenge unwarranted or unjustified listing decisions, for instance, like the polar bear or in this case now ring seals. We're going to intervene in court cases in which the state has an interest, for instance, the Riven Seal decision. That in that case, the North Slope Borough decided to actually challenge the listing, and we intervened as a third party in supporting their decision. We're going to initiate down or delisting petition for recovered species, for instance, the eastern DPS of stellar sea lions in southeast Alaska. We're going to conduct research on at-risk species or listed species to improve knowledge, and we're going to help Alaskans navigate through the ESA process as they have questions. And finally, the governor's budget, as I said, includes a capital request for ADF&G to fund data collection and engage in legal challenges, and also includes an increment for the Department of Law to engage in legal challenges on unwarranted actions that really impact our ability to pay our bills at the state science level. So with that, thank you. I really appreciate the time.
We have a few minutes for questions. Any questions?
I have a brief one.
Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. It's really interesting stuff, and great to hear about the wood bison herd. Did have a question. So as we went down the listings under the endangered species in Alaska, are there any in which the state of Alaska endangered species that Alaska believes are so, but the federal government, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, or the marine, whatever, the NOAA believe are not?
So are there ones that we support on that list? As I said, I think North Pacific right whale is one we clearly support. I think we support the listing of many of these whale species as threatened, the primary threat being over-harvest. And since the International Whaling Commission now has been created, that risk is largely being mitigated, and many of these populations are growing. I don't believe we need critical habitat for that species. I think the primary threat in that case was whaling, and that's now been addressed. And I think it's very similar to the case that we had with Aleutian Island geese. You know, we did not designate critical habitat. It wasn't necessary. The primary threat in that case was predation. We addressed predation. With these whale species, the primary threat's over harvest. We're addressing that. So do you give the full protection of the act, including critical habitat? And then once you do that, identify, you know, all the prey-based species that these, like humpback whales, may be necessary. Now start limiting the harvest of herring and everything else, when in fact whaling, or in the eastern DPS of humpback whales, is probably their breeding habitat in the Sea of Otush that's mostly affecting them, not their feeding grounds.
I'm not sure that he answered your question directly.
Well, I was just curious, thank you, Mr. Chairman, if the state had any endangered species it believes to be endangered under the four areas of concern that the federal government says, no, we don't think that that's...
No, I misunderstood the question, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Senator Stevens, you had a question?
Thank you, Chairman. Years ago, we used to hear a lot about regime change where, I don't know, like the king crab in Kodiak pretty much disappeared and replaced pretty much by pollock, it seems. But where does regime change fit into this? I mean, does that occur? Is it an issue that affects the Endangered Species Act?
That's a very good question, because, you know, many populations have significant amounts of natural variations in their population levels. Take, for instance, the western Arctic caribou herd. You know, that population can be as high as 500,000 and can go down to 180,000 in less than 10 years or less than probably 7 years, largely not as a result of anything that's out there. You have a couple bad winters and you decrease them. Now, should you list that species because the decline over 7 years was from 500,000 down to 170,000? No, we're not going to list that species in the state of Alaska. You know, that population is now growing on its own as predation has whittled down on that herd and as winters have improved. So I think if you ask the federal government, I think that would be an interesting how they would treat that as, you know, over the next 100 years, is there a greater than 1% chance that caribou might go extinct in the Western Arctic herd with climate change? You could probably make an argument. We don't, again, under the state system, we're probably not going to list that species. We're going to monitor it closely. And as necessary, we'll restrict harvest and reduce predation on the herd to pull it out of its predation pits, but we're not going to list it.
I have one question. I don't see any others. The Aleutian shield fern, is that the only, I assume it's a plant, is that the only plant listed under the Endangered Species Act in Alaska?
That's correct.
Was the yellow cedar not listed?
Yellow cedar was not listed, and that was basically through information the state provided through DNR and Fish and Game as to it not being at risk of extinction in the foreseeable future.
Thank you. So thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. Commissioner Vincent Lang, this is the Resources Committee. It's not our responsibility to protect natural resources, but we also have to defend Alaska's right to extract, produce, and harvest Alaska's resources for sustenance and economic survival, which was essentially guaranteed under the Alaska Statehood Act and ANILCA. Thanks for today's talk on the Endangered Species Act, which obviously has the potential to seriously compromise that right. Without any further business to come before the committee, our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 3rd. Where we will be hearing Senate Bill 29, Cook Inlet New Admin Area Permit Buyback. This meeting is adjourned at 5:53 p.m.